Okay, good morning. This is Bio 231, Monday, March 16th, and we're going to finish up the introduction to nervous system chapter today and maybe move on to central nervous system. I'm not too sure. I'll say more about that in a second, but I want to pass the sign-in sheet around before I forget to do that. So please sign in. And we're still scheduled to have an exam on Wednesday, March 25th. And that's supposed to be chapters 10, 11, and 12, but I see an opportunity here today. Maybe we can even sneak chapter 13 in on that test, which would be central nervous system. Okay. And then I had a second thought. And there was a reason why I grouped the test like that, and that's because the muscle chapter is not just one chapter. There's a lot of information there. So then I'm thinking, well, okay, maybe it should only be 10, 11, and 12. And then the next test will have five chapters on it, but those other chapters, aren't as long as muscles. That's the reason why I grouped it that way. So I'm still pondering that, so make sure you come to class to find out what's going to be on that test on the 25th. But so far, we're holding to the schedule that's in the syllabus. Okay, so on the 25th, it's going to be chapters 10, 11, and 12. But I might change my mind depending on how fast we go. So probably you should ask me a lot of questions today. I'm just sort of kidding. Okay, but you are welcome to ask questions anyway, right, anytime. So that's what I'm thinking. Question?
We had a question because her syllabus is different than mine. And
the lab?
Yeah, it sounds like...
The correct lab is the one that came with the manual. Not the one that's in the syllabus. Yeah, the correct one is. But you know, every lab instructor has the ability to switch the schedule around, and the only way to know is to attend the lab and ask questions of your lab instructor how that's going in lab. All right, so all of these schedules are tentative. The reason why the one that's in my syllabus is incorrect is because that was just given to me, and I put it in my syllabus, and I sent it out to the printer, and then somebody made some corrections to it, and the corrections were too late for the printer. But the correct schedule is in your lab manual, okay? So, but again, every lab instructor has the ability to change it one way or the other. All right, so last time we started nervous system. Any questions on nervous system? No? Okay. Nervous system, what are the four basic kinds of tissues that make up the body? Epithelium, connective tissue, muscle tissue, and nervous tissue. Yeah, you should just have that automatically, probably in that order so that you don't ever forget one. All right, that's just the order that we presented it in class. All right, and nervous tissue has got how many different kinds of types of cells associated with it? Two. And what are those types? Neurons and neuroglia. Yeah, neurons and neuroglia. Okay, so I've mentioned this before, but I've had a lot of students come to me and say that they're actually being disturbed by, and not just this class, but a lot of other classes that I'm teaching, and I haven't been paying attention to way back in the far reaches of the class. So some students were being disturbed by people talking and just horsing around during lecture. So I got to pay a little bit more attention to the whole class. So if you're talking, horsing around, I'm going to ask you to leave the class. All right, you're welcome to come back in and actually stay in the class, but not if you're going to detract from other people's learning. Okay, so please just keep it down. All right. All right. So let's see. What was I thinking about? Oh, I was thinking about the different kinds of cells that make up the nervous system. Right. So there are neurons. What are they specialized to do? Yeah, they send electrical signals over, most of them, really long distances. Yeah.
Can I get you a general question? So what is all the information processed in the neuron?
Yeah, it's being processed. You know, you might have to take a physiology class to see how that works. I'm going to talk about processing just a little bit in terms of circuitry at the end of today's lecture. But every neuron, not every neuron, but most neurons by themselves can make decisions for you. So even cells can make decisions for you, and we don't talk about that very much in this class. Okay, so you got to take an advanced class. It goes, what we say, beyond the scope of this class. And guess what? We'll still be learning about that probably for another 100, 200 years. So that's a very interesting question, and you're always going to have to educate yourself on that particular topic. Yeah. Because sometimes the way that our brain works, sometimes it works like an analog circuit, like a radio. Sometimes it works like a digital circuit, like a computer. They're meshed together. So it's all kind of fascinating material to think about. If I can mention something in lecture, I'll try to focus on that to help answer that question. But you'll have to just wait. Okay, so neurons send electrical information long distances. What about neuroglia? What do? They're support cells, so they support the neurons in what they do. All right, so I think maybe, is that where we were? We were just starting to talk about neuroglia and what they looked like and where we found them? Or didn't we get that far yet?
No.
I think we talked about a neuron, the parts of a neuron, right? Okay, so we talked about the parts of the neuron. Let's see, what are the three main structural features of a neuron?
The cell body.
Okay. As a matter of fact, maybe I would like you to start, what you're saying is right, but maybe I would like to have you name these parts of a neuron by how they transmit information. What part of a neuron is is super specialized to receive information? That is the dendrite. Oh, I'm glad I asked this question. It's the dendrite. All right, so when somebody asks you the parts of a neuron, say dendrite, because that's where a signal starts. And then it flows into the cell body, and then it flows down the axon. So if you say it in that order, that just reinforces your idea of how information is transmitted through a neuron. Okay? And then if you want to think of a fourth place that actually sends a signal to the next neuron, you could. It's fine with me if you think of that as being a fourth part. What would you think of the fourth part of a neuron then? Would be the. That's close. I'm actually thinking of the axon terminus, because the axon terminus has a little swelling at the tip, and that's what's going to be used for transmitting information to the next neuron. And we haven't talked about that yet, but please look forward to that. Okay. So, just some general architecture of the nervous system. What are the two main parts of the nervous system? Peripheral and central nervous system. Right, so what makes up the central nervous system?
Brain
and spinal cord. All right, that's great. So I know a lot of times you guys feel like you're just being programmed to say the right answer, but I'm really happy when you say the right answer, so I don't mind. Okay, so brain and spinal... Oh, look, something happened to the... That hasn't done that in a long time. Okay, brain and spinal cord. So remember this diagram right here? I'm going to have to rescale. View. Zoom. All right, so think of this diagram, right, all the time when you're studying the nervous system. That's going to be a helpful diagram. Your book has it sort of in a tabular form instead of this flow diagram right here. Okay. So don't forget, neurons transmit information. They're stimulated on the dendrite, and then an electrical signal develops on the dendrite. It goes over the cell body, and then it gets converted to an electrical signal down the axon, and it flows down the axon to the axon terminus. All right, so there is your central and peripheral nervous system. And this is what is a typical motor neuron. This is, so it's a neuron, and you can see the small processes, the dendrites. Here's the soma. What's another name for soma? The cell body. Right, and then here is that long axon that could be a meter long or maybe even longer, transmitting that electrical information down to the axon terminals. All right, so information is carried as an electrical signal down this axon, and you should be able to identify this cell, the type of neuron that we have right here, as well as a supporting cell that you see surrounding pieces of it. This kind of neuron is what we call a multipolar neuron, and where it's used in the nervous system is a motor neuron. And if you go back to that diagram, a motor division of the nervous system is very important. Okay, so because the peripheral nervous system can be broken up into a motor division, all right, which is called what?
Efferent.
And then the other division would be the afferent. Yeah, afferent. Okay, and so what we're looking at right here is a typical motor neuron. The support cell that we see are these Schwann cells. and they kind of look like little beads or pearls that wrap themselves around the axon. And, oh, that's where I left off. Neuroglia cells. What is their job? We said they support neurons to do their job. And so we're going to look at the functions of a couple neuroglia. This neuroglia right here, the Schwann cell, speeds up the rate of an action potential. And when they wrap themselves around an axon, they lay down a chemical called myelin. It's a lipid, and lipid is an insulator. And so that isolates the electrical signal and contains it within the axon so that the impulse speed is very, very fast. If these Schwann cells were absent from the axon right here, the impulse conduction would be slow. So what would you rather have? Ways to transmit information fast or slow? Say you're crossing railroad tracks and you see a train coming at you. Do you want to cross the railroad tracks like a sloth, or do you want to like get out of the way? Yeah, get out of the way, right? So faster is better for impulse transmission. So the Schwann cell is important for that. The chemical compound is called myelin. And this is a multipolar motor neuron. Okay. Oh, yeah, we talked about that slide last time. And we talked about this slide last time, too. Okay, because we were now starting to talk about how information is transmitted between two neurons. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? That's a synapse. Yeah, a synapse. And there are two kinds of synapses. Oh, who can tell me the two kinds of synapses? There's chemical and electrical. That's right. So electrical synapses are not very common, only in a few places. And electrical synapses allow electrical information to go from the presynaptic cell into the postsynaptic cell. Did everybody see that nomenclature right there? The presynaptic cell is what? Upstream of the synapse. The postsynaptic cell is downstream, or you could say proximal and distal in terms of transmitting information. An electrical synapse means that electrical signals can go directly from one cell to the next. That's rare in our bodies. The most kind, the most frequently used, is the chemical synapse. So information flows over the presynaptic neuron as an electrical signal, and then to go across the synapse, which is a space, it has to be converted into a chemical signal, and then when that chemical reaches the postsynaptic cell, that information gets converted back into an electrical signal, which then flows down the what? Dendrite, cell body, axon. So for a chemical synapse, what do we got in this part? In this part of the figure, how is this signal being transmitted? Electrical, and here is chemical, and here is electrical once again. All right, so we need to look in some detail what's happening in this space between the two cells in a chemical synapse. And I call that the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, because once you see how that works for one kind of synapse, then you pretty much know how it works for all synapses with some modifications. Yeah. Oh, we measure them all the time with electrodes. So we can make tiny electrodes and actually put them inside of a cell. Okay, and then actually measure that electrical activity. Yeah, that's exactly how we know how neurons work and maybe how certain kinds of neurotoxins work, because we can measure those electrical voltages. And we don't usually do that in situ, for instance, in a human body, but we can measure maybe thousands or millions of neurons at one time by putting just surface electrodes on somebody's brain and measure an EEG, an electroencephalogram. Or we can put electrodes on somebody's chest and measure electrical activity of their heart. What's that called? Electrocardiogram. Okay, so that's just not one cell, but that's all the cells of the heart. Or we can put electrodes on somebody's muscles and actually measure electrical signals of whole muscles. Anybody know what that's called? That's called an electromyogram. So there are ways to measure all these electrical events, all right? But in a person, we don't like to put electrodes in a single cell because that's pretty invasive. But we can get information by picking up electrical activity from certain parts of their body, like their heart or their brain, for instance. All right, and then, oh, yeah, we talked about this last time, different kinds of synapses. So for instance, these right here would be axosomatic, these would be axodendritic, and then this would be axoaxonic because of where the junction actually exists. Right? And remember, in anatomy, you can always combine terms and put them together as long as you do what? Put an O between them. Right? And that's a legal word. So even any kind of practicum that you do, right, if you put two words together, you've got to make sure you put an O between them. All right, so here is that synapse. So we're zooming in way into, let's see, what kind of synapse does this look like now, right here? That's an axodendritic, axo, don't forget that O, axodendritic synapse. And you can see that little swelling right there. That's the terminal button. Sometimes it's called a Bouton terminale, sometimes called terminal button. What does it say in your book? Axon terminus, all right? Terminal, axon terminal, goes by all those different names. And moving these vesicles around, these vesicles contain the chemical that's going to carry the signal across the synapse. And there's, since that chemical is being secreted by a neuron, it goes by a general name. Anybody know what the general name of that signaling chemical is called? Since it's secreted by a neuron and it's transmitting information across the synapse, it's called a neurotransmitter. All right, a neurotransmitter. And I think we talked about the neuromuscular junction. All right, so a neuromuscular junction is a special kind of synapse between a motor neuron and a skeletal muscle fiber. So you should see some similarities. So the neurotransmitter is in these vesicles. And when an electrical impulse comes down the axon, it causes the movement of these synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane where they fuse and they exocytose neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft right here. But that takes energy to do that. Where does this Bouton terminale get energy to move all these things around? Yeah, ATP from where? Yeah, the mitochondria. And look, there's a lot of mitochondria in the axon terminal providing ATP. All right, well, what else do you have to know? Well, what's the link between this electrical signal coming down and then movement of all these synaptic vesicles with neurotransmitter? Yes. Okay, and I think we talked about that in terms of muscle as well. When an electrical impulse comes down, it opens up a way for calcium to enter the cell. We call that a calcium channel. And then calcium floods through the axon terminus, and that's going to be the signal inside the cell for moving these vesicles around. And if there's no calcium on the outside to move to the inside, then these synaptic vesicles won't be released into the synaptic cleft. All right, so let's finish the story a little bit, and then I'll ask you some questions. So now we got neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft right here. It's going to diffuse to the postsynaptic membrane. And this postsynaptic membrane could be one of two locations. Two common locations would be a dendrite or the cell body. Right, that would be what, an axodendritic synapse or an axosomatic synapse. And there is going to be a receptor on the postsynaptic membrane that's going to bind the neurotransmitter. And when neurotransmitter binds to the receptor, that sets up another electrical signal that flows over the rest of the cell. Right, so you got to have binding of neurotransmitter to receptors in this postsynaptic density right here. There are proteins in the membrane, because remember, a membrane, what's a nice sophisticated way of thinking of a membrane? The fluid mosaic model. And what does that mean? Inside that membrane, there could be all kinds of stuff put in there, like receptors, or channels, ion channels, or antigens. Okay? And so in this particular case, there are going to be receptors that bind this neurotransmitter. So what's a neurotransmitter, maybe that you're familiar with? Give me the specific name of a neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine is a really good example that's used at the neuromuscular junction, that's used a lot between neurons as well. So when the synapse is active, a nerve impulse comes down, calcium enters this axon terminus that causes this vesicle with acetylcholine to move to the presynaptic density, and it exocytoses acetylcholine into the synaptic cleft, which then diffuses to the postsynaptic membrane, binds to an ion channel, and then that starts up another electrical signal on the postsynaptic cell. So for instance, could this postsynaptic cell be stimulated if this axon terminal right here couldn't make acetylcholine anymore? What would happen? Yeah, the information would stop in the presynaptic cell and wouldn't start up again in the postsynaptic cell. So synaptic transmission would be stopped. Right? What happens if the cell made lots of acetylcholine and put it in these vesicles, but there was not enough calcium in somebody's body to enter when a nerve impulse came down? What would happen to synaptic transmission in that circumstance? It would stop as well. All right, so how about what happens if this axon terminus could release acetylcholine into the synaptic cleft over here, but there was no receptor in the postsynaptic membrane? What would happen? Synaptic transmission would stop as well. So you can see that you need all these pieces for synapses to work properly. Yeah, question.
If those neurotransmitters move through the membrane by lenses of calcium, what if the calcium brings together in order to do that?
Okay, I'm not sure I understand your question. Maybe see me after class.
Yeah.
Okay, because it might go a little bit beyond what we can talk about in here. All right, so what mineral or what ion is important for synaptic transmission?
Calcium.
Yeah, calcium is an ion. Where else do you need to have calcium in proper levels to be healthy? In your bones, to have strong bones, and also in muscles. Why? In muscles because they're hard and rigid like bone, or what? For what? For what reason? Why do you need calcium in muscle? For contraction, to get the actin and myosin filaments to slide over each other. All right, so now you know three places where it's important to have calcium. In muscles for contraction, in nerve fibers for synaptic transmission, and bones to make bones strong. So if you get to pick two places, where would you like to have proper levels of calcium to be healthy? Muscles. Okay, muscle, yeah, because you have to breathe. You need a diaphragm. What would be your second choice?
In neurons,
so that your brain will function, right? Yeah, so for synaptic transmission. And then the third place where you would choose to put proper levels of calcium would be your bones, right? And your body realizes that too. And so when you're deficient in calcium, what happens as we get older? Guess what tissue gets sacrificed in order to make calcium at the proper levels in nerves and muscles? And that's bones. What's that condition called?
Osteoporosis,
right? All right, so calcium is very important in many places of your body. All right, so here is a synapse, and you should see that it's pretty similar to that neuromuscular junction. The only thing is that these neurons don't move around very much, and so there aren't a lot of connections between the axon terminus and the postsynaptic cell, unlike the neuromuscular junction, which is always, what, bouncing around because the muscle contracts. So that's the really big difference. And in neurons, there are many different kinds of neurotransmitters. In the neuromuscular junction, there's only one neurotransmitter in every single skeletal muscle. And what's that neurotransmitter? That's acetylcholine. Would you like to know some neurotransmitters that are used in synapses at the between two different neurons? Just for fun? That is, acetylcholine is used. Then there is norepinephrine. Okay, then maybe some of you have heard of something called adrenaline. Well, adrenaline is a little modification of noradrenaline. And then there's dopamine, and then there's gamma-aminobutyric acid, and then there's glutamate, okay, glycine. So there's all different kinds of neurotransmitters that are used in different parts of our nervous system. And it's fascinating to know what all those different neurotransmitters do, but you got to take a physiology class to understand some of it. So don't ask me any questions on that one right now. Okay? Okay? Okay, you just have to know what a neurotransmitter is what? It's the chemical signal that moves across the synapse, carries information across the synapse. Okay. I think maybe I jumped ahead just a little bit. Okay, Let's talk about some of these cells. All right, so I'm going to talk about morphology of neurons and neuroglia. All right, so here are the three different cell types that you have to know. The top one with one really long axon and a bunch of dendrites coming off the soma right here, that's a multipolar neuron. And then you should also be able to tell me what it's used for in your body. There's a couple locations. It's used as a motor neuron. So what kind of pathway is a motor pathway? Efferent. Yeah, it's an efferent pathway. And you're going to know what part of the central nervous system this is pretty soon. All right, but there's some gray matter in the spinal cord. This is where the cell body is for a motor neuron. And then it leaves the spinal cord and it goes all the way to a skeletal muscle. So it just takes one cell to go all the way from your spinal cord to a skeletal muscle. And it's this kind of cell right here. The other place where you find a multipolar neuron is in a neuron that we call an interneuron or an association neuron. And these, okay, so here's one right here. And what can you tell me about where it is located? Where is it located? Is it located partly in the peripheral nervous system or partly in the central nervous system or completely in the peripheral or completely in the central? It's completely within the central nervous system. It doesn't enter or leave. It is always found completely in the central nervous system someplace. All right, and this is what we call an association neuron. And association neurons are important for signal processing, which is what we're going to look at in a little bit. Because interneurons can share information with many different kinds of circuits in our brain. All right, that's a multipolar. Bipolar neurons are fairly rare in the nervous system. They're always associated with special senses. And we're going to look at special senses pretty soon. For instance, your eyes, so they're important in vision, in hearing, and olfaction. What's olfaction?
Smell.
Smell, that's right. Okay. That's a bipolar neuron. So a bipolar neuron just means that there's a central cell body. And there are dendrites connected with really one long process. And then there's an axon. And how could you tell that these are dendrites over here and not dendrites over here? Because, yeah, the axon terminals or the synaptic knobs are on the axon. See these little swellings right here? So this is the receiving end of a neuron, and this is the sending end. In order for a neuron to send information, it's got to be able to release a chemical. And since these dendrites here don't have synaptic vesicles to release a chemical, it can't send a chemical signal anywhere because it's got nothing to send. All right? All right, the third kind is what we call a unipolar neuron. And there's a cell body, and then there's a very short single process that bifurcates into a central process and a peripheral process. All right, so when I say peripheral, what should you be thinking of? Peripheral means, what did you learn for peripheral? What's a good definition of peripheral? Yeah, as opposed to central nervous system. So peripheral means outside your brain and spinal cord, so in your arms, for instance. This is the part of the neuron that is in your peripheral nervous system, and then this is the part of the neuron that is where? That actually enters your central nervous system. So this neuron, again, is found between the peripheral and central nervous system, and if this is a motor neuron that goes between the central and peripheral nervous system, all right, this one is not motor. This is the other one. This is a sensory neuron that brings information from the periphery into the central nervous system, and then it passes that information on, right, by releasing neurotransmitter right here. And you can see, right, you might have receptors in your skin, okay, and these could be maybe simple nerve endings for temperature or pain, and that sends impulses to the spinal cord, and then it enters the central nervous system. Now, what does this look like right here? If you look at this figure, see that little, that's the cell body. That's right. And all cell bodies of sensory neurons are going to be located in this particular region, and that's what we call the dorsal root ganglion. All right, so I'll mention that again a couple of different times. All right, so we call that the dorsal root ganglia because there are two ways. There are two ways that information can enter or leave the spinal cord. And this right here is the posterior part, right? So the spinous processes of vertebrae are going to be sticking out over here. And this is the anterior side. What's another name for anterior side? Anterior is the same as ventral, right? All right, so you see two roots. There's one here and there's one here. These are the only two ways to enter or leave the central nervous system at the level of the spinal cord. And so this one, the anterior one, we call the ventral root. And the posterior one here is what we call the dorsal root. All right, so when you look at this slide right here, you can see, and I'll probably just tell you right now, that these roots are not two-way streets. They can only be one-way streets. One root has afferent pathways and the other has efferent pathways. So who can tell me which root is for afferent pathways? It's that posterior one, which we call the dorsal root. This is for all sensory information enters the central nervous system this way. And then for leaving the central nervous system, it has to leave the ventral root. All right, so the ventral root is 100% motor and the dorsal root is 100% sensory. It can never change from that. All right, so remember, impulses can only go in one direction down these neurons, so there have to be two different pathways for that. Okay. I want to look at some neuroglia first. Okay, here are some neuroglia that we find, we're going to break down neuroglia into two different locations in our bodies. And this first location right here are the neuroglia that we find in the central nervous system. So these are neuroglial cells or support cells in the CNS. So I'm probably going to use that term from now on. What does CNS mean? Central nervous system. PNS means? Peripheral nervous system. Okay. So we got four cell types. Astrocytes, because they kind of look like stars. All right. We got microglia, because it has all these little spindly projections coming off. Ependymal cells. And then we have oligodendrocytes. So you'll have to be able to identify these different cell types. All right. And?
How, if they pretty much look like an L neuron?
They look like a neuron?
Especially, yeah, especially the
C. Like this one here?
Yeah.
I don't see an axon here.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So this one does kind of look like a dendrite, but this is nervous tissue, so I guess I wouldn't be shocked to see that they share some morphology with a neuron, because they're the same kind of cell, only specialized to do something a little bit different. All right. I have a flash quiz that you guys will take to help you practice the names of all these different neurons and neuroglia and their functions. This astrocyte right here, you can see that it has processes that that go up and touch a neuron. Right, the yellow structure is a piece of a neuron right here. And then other pieces of the same cell have processes that go and touch what? A blood vessel. All right, so an astrocyte can act like a bridge between a blood vessel and a neuron. And so, for instance, astrocytes can actually pick up nutrients from the blood and transport them directly into a neuron to maintain the health of a neuron. So that's kind of handy to have that special delivery system. All right, so that's one function of an astrocyte. This microglia cell right here is an immunological cell. It fights infection that can find its way into the brain. And maybe if there's a tumor, right? If the microglia cell can recognize it as being a tumor, it will destroy the tumor as well. So that's the job of microglia, to fight infection and tumors. And guess what? We've probably all had brain tumors, and maybe even brain infections. But what? These microglia have been smart enough to kill those infections and those tumor cells before they became a problem for us. Right? It's only under certain circumstances in some individuals that we don't always understand that the tumor cells might get smarter than these microglia cells, and then somebody actually has a brain tumor that has to be dealt with clinically. All right, the ependymal cells. These line the cavities that are inside the brain. So there are cavities inside the brain filled with cerebral spinal fluid. We haven't looked at those yet. But probably all of you are aware that sometimes maybe when somebody is suspected of having meningitis, They have to pull fluid out of somebody's central nervous system and analyze it for maybe blood or for viruses or bacteria, maybe even fungi. What's that procedure called when you actually... A spinal tap. Right. So you do have fluid-filled cavities inside your central nervous system. And here's that special lining that separates the spinal fluid from your actual neurons, which is down in this region. And again, that just helps protect your neurons from maybe infectious agents that have found their way into that cerebral spinal fluid. So it helps protect the brain. That's the job of the ependymal cells. And then in a couple locations in the brain, these ependymal cells are highly vascularized, and those areas actually make and secrete cerebral spinal fluid into the ventricles of the brain. The ventricles are those spaces that are filled with CSF. So ependymal cells can help make CSF as well. And when I say CSF, what does that mean? That means cerebral spinal fluid.
Question.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the ependymal cells. The ependymal cells separate the cerebral spinal fluid, which is in the ventricles of the brain, from the neurons that actually make up the brain in this space over here. So it acts as a barrier. So if there's something harmful that has gotten into the cerebral spinal fluid, it doesn't necessarily mean that you will lose consciousness or have an infection of your neurons, because there's this little barrier that helps protect the neurons. All right, so we just can't function at all without a brain, right? And so the morphology of these neuroglia cells helps to protect the brain. The ependymal cells help protect the neurons from CSF. And then look at this astrocyte right here. It forms a special coating of these capillaries. So another job of an astrocyte is to protect the neurons of the brain from harmful chemical compounds that could be found in the blood. And that's what we call the blood-brain barrier. So astrocytes help make up the blood-brain barrier that helps protect neurons from things that are in the circulatory system. Right? And, for instance, most things that we eat end up in our circulatory system. But, as you know, there's some things that we eat and drink that are not particularly good for our neurons. All right? And, yeah, alcohol is just one of those things. And it's a blood-brain barrier that helps protect those neurons from letting all those toxins have access to our brain. All right, because we wouldn't make it very far without that. So astrocytes also help make up the blood-brain barrier. All right, and the last cell right here is an oligodendrocyte. So you can see one cell body and numerous processes coming off. And then you can see it wrapping around an axon. So an oligodendrocyte is the counterpart to the Schwann cell that puts down a myelin sheath around axons to insulate them. And when an axon is insulated, that means an electrical impulse travels very rapidly down an axon as opposed to very slowly. So oligodendrocytes are myelinating cells in the central nervous system. Myelin is the chemical compound that acts as an insulator around this axon right here. So, in your everyday life, have you ever thought about electrical wires and insulation? Ever? Yeah? Okay, because, for instance, I think I had a toaster one time, and the insulation was coming off a little bit, and I went to unplug it, and guess what happened? The electricity went right out of the wire into me. And how did anybody ever shock themselves?
Yeah.
Nobody in here? Oh, it happened to you one time, but you were spared because something clicked off or something?
No,
oh, yeah. So insulation is important to what? To contain the electricity into that wire. You would never really think of knowingly, like, unplug a toaster or a hair dryer or a dishwasher. Well, those aren't a microwave. What else? Toaster, maybe a dryer. Maybe you have an electric dryer, unless the wires have what? Insulation on them, right? So these myelinating cells produce insulation to keep the electricity inside the axon. And the kind of cells that do that in the central nervous system are called? In the central nervous system are called? Oligodendrocytes. And they have multiple processes wrapping myelin around. One last thing before I forget. Clinically, these are really important because Your brain thinks kind of on a clock, okay? Just like computers do. And if certain parts of your brain aren't on the same clock as other parts, guess how information is shared? Very poorly. If one part of your brain is looking for information and it doesn't arrive till later, well, then it might be too late to make use of that information, right? So how nerve impulses arrive in different parts of your brain has to be on time, right? Just like if you were going to take a bus or something, if you were there to take a bus and the bus left without you, then what would happen? You'd just be stuck, right? Well, certain people have problems with this. Their brain gets stuck, in a sense, right? And it gets stuck because there is a disease where these oligodendrocytes and these processes that myelinate axons become damaged and they actually dissolve away. So now that person's brain is devoid of myelin in key places in their brain, and that produces motor deficits and cognitive disorders and things like that. Does anybody know what that disease process is called that demyelinates certain parts of somebody's brain? That's actually called multiple sclerosis, MS, multiple sclerosis. And fortunately, we've made a lot of good progress in treating that disease. It's an episodic kind of disorder. It comes and goes, comes and goes, and with proper medications, we can extend the period of time from reoccurrence. And depending on each individual, sometimes people can live pretty normal lives with multiple sclerosis, but it used to be a really horrible, terrible disease. Yeah. Central nervous system. In the brain.
Okay.
Brain and spinal cord. Brain and spinal cord. Okay. The counterpart in the peripheral nervous system is going to be these guys right here. And that is that little guy, it's just a single cell that's wrapping itself around an axon, that's a Schwann cell. Nonetheless, it still synthesizes myelin, makes a myelin sheath around the axon, and when it's there, impulses travel how? Fast down an axon. They're very speedy. Okay? Okay, so here we see two different kinds of support cells in the peripheral nervous system, the Schwann cell for myelin, and then these cells right here that surround the cell body of a unipolar neuron. This cell body is going to be located in the dorsal root ganglia, right? Because what's the function of this neuron right here again? Is it association, is it motor, or is it sensory? It's sensory. It's bringing information into the central nervous system, and signals can only enter via the dorsal root. Right, the dorsal root, and right in the dorsal root is going to be a group of these nerve cell bodies, a big node of them, containing thousands or 10,000s of these cells, and a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system is called a ganglion. So ganglion is like a node packed full of nerve cell bodies, right, of these sensory fibers right here. And they're surrounded by neuroglia cells that helps keep them healthy. And these neuroglia cells that support the cell body right here is called a satellite cell because it kind of just, they form all the way around them. All right, so those are the kinds of cells. Here's a nice slide that compares and contrasts central nervous system with peripheral nervous system. All right, how do you know this is peripheral nervous system right here? Yeah, because you got Schwann cells around the axons, right? That's a nice myelin sheath. All right, and then how do you know that this is the central nervous system? Because the myelin sheath is made by oligodendrocytes. Yeah, oligodendrocytes. So Schwann cells and oligodendrocytes have similar function in that they speed up the rate of a nerve impulse. The only way that they're a little bit different, this is not on the test, is that when an axon gets cut in the peripheral nervous system, the Schwann cells actually help regenerate the nerve going to its effector organ. It promotes the regeneration of a nerve in the peripheral nervous system. But oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system, when an axon gets cut, it does the opposite. It actually defeats the regeneration of this axon growing back to its effector. All right, and that's why spinal cord injuries are what? They're permanent. They're permanent because of these oligodendrocytes that prevent regeneration in the central nervous system. But people can actually grow back nerves in the peripheral nervous system because we don't have oligodendrocytes there. All right, so this just shows how myelin is wrapped around an axon. Okay. All right, so let's see. Okay, so I do talk about conduction speeds. Okay, the little breaks in the myelin sheath, like right here and right here, that's a node of Ranvier. And so when an electrical signal moves down a myelinated axon, it doesn't move molecule by molecule by molecule by molecule. It actually hops from one node of Ranvier to the next, to the next, to the next. And that's why it's faster. The same thing in the central nervous system. An electrical impulse hops from here to here to here. So that just should give you a little feel why it's faster. Let me just see if you have to know this. Yeah, you do. Okay. If an electrical signal hops down an axon, what's the relative speed? What's that relative speed when it hops down?
Fast.
It's fast. Okay. We call that saltatory conduction. I didn't see that on the slide, but I think that's in your notes. Saltatory conduction is when a nerve impulse hops down an axon, it's fast. But if there's an axon that's not myelinated, the electrical signal has to move molecule by molecule by molecule. That means it's slow. The way that we talk about that is that it's called continuous conduction. So you should be familiar with the terminology saltatory versus continuous. All right, so for what kind of axon propagates electricity via continuous methods? Unmyelinated or non-myelinated. Okay, if there's an axon that is conducting in a saltatory fashion, tell me something about that axon.
It's myelinated.
Okay, and then in the central nervous system, what kind of neuroglia cell is providing for saltatory conduction? In the central nervous system, that is? Oligodendrocytes. And in the peripheral nervous system, it is the Schwann cell. Yeah. Yeah, the electrical signal just hops from one node to another. And yes, we can measure that with a voltmeter. We can see it hopping with a voltmeter and oscilloscope. Now, would that be cool to do that in lab? Yeah, okay. Well, first, you got to understand the basic stuff first. First anatomy and then some physiology. We're making plans to do that, but not recently. We haven't done that recently. Okay. Then what was your question?
What do you mean with saltatory?
Okay, right now the picture you have in your mind is just electricity hopping from one node to the next. Okay, that's good for right now. Yeah?
Where do the continuous conduction, are they in the central nervous system?
It could be either. It's going to be down an axon. It's going to be on an axon someplace. But for continuous conduction, it has to be a non-myelinated axon. Yeah, they're all, and what do they do? Yeah, that's right. So oligodendrocytes provide for saltatory conduction. But what part of your nervous system? That's a question that I would like an answer to. The central nervous system. Central nervous system. And who does that job in the peripheral nervous system? That is the Schwann cell. All right, so that function is pretty much similar between oligodendrocytes and Schwann cells. The only big difference is that one kind of cell will allow for regeneration of an axon, but another cell will stop it from happening. Okay? So the Schwann cell allows for regeneration, oligodendrocytes prevent regeneration.
So not all neurons would
have Schwann cells? Not all neurons have Schwann cells. This is true. And in the next couple chapters, we'll see where that is. We'll make an interesting distinction between them. Okay? Continuous are non-myelinated. Right. So what do you think is a more advanced feature in an evolutionary sense, having myelinated axons or non-myelinated axons? Okay, so myelinated axons are a recent advance in evolution. They're faster, they're better. So you can imagine if we have a very ancient, old part of a nervous system, all right, which we do, it relies on non-myelinated axons. And one of the oldest parts of our nervous system is the part of our nervous system that automatically takes care of our body. It's called the autonomic nervous system. So like what we use for breathing and controlling our blood pressure and things like that, that was developed millions of years before evolution came up with myelinated axons for increasing the speed of conduction. Right. We don't talk much about evolution in here, but that's maybe one thing to kind of think of. Okay, so we talked about the synapse. All right. Okay. Let me read this question here, see if it makes sense. Can information ever be passed from the postsynaptic neuron back to the presynaptic neuron through a synapse?
No.
No. Why is that? Only the postsynaptic have the receptors, and only the presynaptic have the neurotransmitter or the signaling molecules. Right? So information can only flow in one direction. How is information transmitted within a neuron? What kind of signal? Electrical signal. And how is it transmitted between neurons? As a chemical signal. Only a few rare circumstances can it go as an electrical signal. Okay. All right, so I want to give you a little bit of an overview of the cell membrane potential. Okay, cell membrane potential. Let's see what kind of pictures I got for that. I think I got to go back over here someplace. Wow, I don't have much for that. Okay. Well, here is an axon right here. I thought I had another picture. Let me just see. Okay. I don't. Okay. Well, there are a couple important ions in our body. Does anybody know what an ion is? What's an ion? Okay, so here we have over here the periodic table with a bunch of chemical elements on there. Okay, and one of those elements is going to be something, for instance, that is given this symbol right here. And maybe some of you that are close can look and see on the chemical chart what that is. This stands for sodium. And A stands for sodium because in Greek the word is natrium. All right, and chlorine has this symbol right here. Okay? And when you put sodium and chlorine together, what do you get? You get sodium chloride. What's sodium chloride? That's salt. Okay? And these are some very important electrolytes in your body because when you put salt in water, what happens to them? Does a crystal just fall to the bottom and just stay at the bottom forever and ever? It does what? It dissolves. Yeah, almost complete. You can put a lot of sodium chloride in water, it will just dissolve in water. And the reason is because it breaks apart, it forms a sodium and a chloride. And we call these ions because this element right here grabs an electron from sodium and becomes negative. And when sodium loses an electron, what does it become? It becomes positive. So these things right here are what we call ions. In medicine, in clinical realms, ions we call electrolytes. Call these electrolytes. Because why? They have electrical charges on them. That's why they're called electrolytes. So they kind of go by two different names. All right? And if we take the sodium from over from here and move it to over here, guess what we have? Guess what we have when we take this positive charge and move it over there? That's an electrical current. So a current is just electrical charge that's in motion going from one place to another. Okay? That's an electrical current. So our bodies have electrical currents because of these electrolytes that make up our body. What are some other important electrolytes in our body? We've got potassium, right? That's because it was called kalium way back when, potassium. Calcium is another one. It actually has two positive charges, magnesium. We have lots of electrolytes in our body. So our bodies are essentially what? Very, what's the nature of our bodies? Very, very electrical because of all these electrolytes that make up our body. All right? And it has electrical currents associated with them. I know what I was going to say, and I kind of forgot to mention this. So electrical activities in our body are very important for maintaining our life. And so a lot of times you have to measure all of these different kinds of ions in somebody's body. You got to draw blood and measure them. And you might have to do it in a hurry. Right? So you might be in an emergency room or something, and a doctor's going to turn around and look at you and say, we need some lights on this patient stat. All right, so what are you going to do when somebody says, we need some lights on this patient right away? Are you going to go get like a bunch of flashlights and shine them on the patient? No, you're going to draw some blood and measure, right, send it to the lab and get some levels of these different ions or electrolytes. All right, so that kind of breaches the topic a little bit. The last thing that you should know is that every cell in your body acts like a battery, all right, which is kind of a strange concept, I think, right? It acts like a battery, and when you have a battery, how many terminals does a battery have on it? Okay, yeah, it has a negative terminal and a positive terminal. It's got two terminals, right? So in order to measure a voltage on something like a battery, you need two terminals. So if you're going to measure a voltage, you need two electrodes. Put one on one terminal and one on the other, right, in order to measure what that voltage is. Well, every cell acts like a battery because here's a diagram of a cell. What do we have in this particular case when the cell is at rest? What kind of charge is predominantly on the inside? Negative. And what is predominantly on the outside? Is positive. Right? And since there is a separation of charge, that cell is acting just like a battery. And what maintains that is basically ATP, right? Just like all the other energy-requiring processes in your body. All right, so what can happen? And I tell you what can you tell me about the nature of opposite electrical charges? Okay, so if we have a glass full of water with sodium and chloride dissolved in it, and then we let the water evaporate, what's going to happen? These guys are going to get back together again to form crystals. Because what can you tell me about electrical charges? Somebody told me already. They attract each other. So opposite charges attract like charges. Like if we had another anion right here, these are going to repel each other. Right, so opposite charges attract. That's the other thing that you should know about. Maybe some other time. We'll talk about redox. Redox is real important. Redox is important, but not right now. Okay. Redox is important. All right. So, what can you tell me about this positive charge right here? Where does it want to go? It wants to go inside the cell. This is exactly true. Okay? So I'm going to have to draw this slide on the board right here. So here we have a cell. Here we have a cell, and there is a lot of sodium on the outside and just a little bit on the inside. And then we have a lot of potassium on the inside and just a little bit on the outside. This is at rest. And when the cell gets stimulated, it opens up a channel for sodium. All right, and guess which way sodium wants to go? It wants to go inside the cell because the inside of the cell is negative. And when sodium enters a cell, what happens to this negative charge inside the cell? Yeah, it gets canceled out when sodium goes in. So when sodium goes in, this is what we call depolarization. All right, so that's the second thing. All right, and then after sodium goes in, the inside of the cell becomes positive. And at that time, there's another channel that opens up, namely potassium. So if the inside of the cell is positive, what can you tell me about the outside of the cell? It becomes negative. And so now which way does potassium want to go? It wants to go outside. So it moves like that. This is the second phase. This is called repolarization. All right, one last question. When potassium leaves, what happens to the electrical charge inside the cell? Okay, when positive charges leave, then it becomes negative again. It goes back to where it was at rest. So these two events right here, depolarization and repolarization, when they work together just like that, that's what we call an action potential. And an action potential can actually move down an axon that we see right here. So here's a cell at rest. What ion is high on the outside of the cell, a neuron that's at rest? Okay, yeah, you just got to memorize that. Just say sodium is high on the outside. What is high on the inside? Potassium. Okay, when a cell's at rest. But when it gets stimulated, what happens? Positives enter. A lot of positives enter, right? So sodium enters the cell when the cell gets stimulated. What do we call that? That is what we call depolarization. And depolarization is due to what ion?
Sodium.
The sodium. And then the other question you would ask yourself, what direction is it moving in? It's going from outside to inside. That's depolarization. All right. And then what's the second phase of an action potential? Repolarization. What ion is that due to? That's due to potassium. And which way is potassium moving? It's moving from inside to outside. And so don't forget, because these ions have an electrical charge, you should think of this as being almost like an electrical current moving across the membrane, causing depolarization and repolarization of the cell. And if this action potential due to those sodium and potassium currents is moving down an axon, what do we call that? That's what we call an action potential in motion, right? Action potential when it's in motion. That's equal to a nerve impulse. And how do nerve impulses move through a neuron? Okay, but through a neuron, can it flow both directions or one direction? Just one direction. And what is the direction that a nerve impulse flows? From dendrite to cell body and then to an axon and then down the axon to the axon terminus. So that nerve impulse is what? It's just an action potential in motion. Different segments of the membrane, and an action potential has got two parts to it. What are the two general parts to an action potential? Depolarization and repolarization. And does it have to go in that order?
No.
What always comes first? Depolarization or repolarization? Yeah, it does have to go in that order. So depolarization has to happen first, all right, and then repolarization after that. So what are the two most important ions for an action potential?
Sodium and
potassium. Which one is responsible for depolarization? For depolarization, the one that's important is sodium. And which way does sodium move? It moves from outside to inside. And then for repolarization, what ion is important? Potassium. And which way does it move? Yeah, the opposite way, from inside to outside. All right, so that's what you have to know about the battery nature of cells. And then, after all of these ions move around, guess what restores the balance of sodium and potassium? ATP, all right, is going to kick sodium out, and it's going to draw potassium in to get back to the resting condition. All right, so that's how all neurons work. And as a matter of fact, that's even how electrical signals flow over skeletal muscles, pretty much that same way. Okay, that nerve impulse, we talked about that. All right, so here are some definitions before we get into the nervous system, because I'll be using some of these definitions pretty soon. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so I drew it here. Oh, that's a good question. I should have read the question there. So here we see the cell membrane, right? But remember, the cell membrane is not just a phospholipid bilayer, but it's what, the fluid mosaic. It's got all kinds of different proteins dissolved in the membrane. This protein right here, all right, I'll maybe draw it like that, all right, is a channel. And so this is a sodium channel right here. Sometimes the sodium channel is, in this particular case, does it look open or closed? It looks closed. And if there is a stimulus, guess what happens? It opens up. And then what can happen? Sodium can enter. And then after a period of time, guess what happens? It closes again. And then the cell will wait for another signal, and guess what happens? And when the sodium channel opens, what does that cause? I like that answer. It causes depolarization of the cell because sodium can enter the cell. All right, then down over here, guess what? You have a potassium channel. And sometimes it's open, sometimes it's closed. And when it opens up, guess what can happen? Repolarization. Right, and then it's going to close after that. So membrane channels or ion channels. Yeah, ion channels. Now let me see, there are different kinds of ion channels, and I think that's probably good enough for you to know that it's an ion channel. Okay, which are special proteins that are put in the cell membranes. All right, so let's look at some nervous system terms. But before, so we're actually going to switch topics a little bit and get more to anatomy, not so much physiology. So this was like a little physiology, but it's good that you sort of become aware that these are some of the things that you're going to have to look for when you take a physiology class. All right. So don't forget, action potential's got two parts. First one is depolarization. Second one is repolarization. Depolarization, sodium entering the cell. Repolarization, potassium leaving. So just memorize it just like that. All right, nervous system terms. Gray matter. All right, so we have two different kinds of matter. We got gray matter and white matter. And when we were looking at axons covered with myelin, like a Schwann cell or oligodendrocytes, that myelin has a white color to it. All right, so, and what part of a neuron didn't have myelin around it? Did not have myelin? Okay, the cell body and dendrites didn't have myelin. Only the axons had myelin. Okay, so gray matter is going to be parts of the nervous system that doesn't have myelin around it. So it's going to be a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites someplace. Right, but not axons that are myelinated. That wouldn't be gray matter. So gray matter is going to be, gray matter does not have myelin, because myelin will make something look white, because myelin is a lipid, it has kind of a white color to it. All right, so gray matter is a group or cluster of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Because nerve cell bodies and dendrites don't have what? They never have myelin sheaths around them. Ever. In no circumstance will they ever have myelin around them. Okay? So that's gray matter. The central nervous system cortex is gray matter. So in the central nervous system cortex, what do you find? You find Yeah, which is? Cell bodies and dendrites. So there's on the surface of your brain, you have lots of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but very few what? Axons that are myelinated. So that's where nerve cell bodies and dendrites hang out. On the surface of your brain, and the surface of every organ is called the? What do we call the surface of any organ? Like the surface of a bone. The superficial part of a bone is the cortex, for instance. Yeah, it's the cortex. All right, so CNS cortex is gray matter on the surface of the brain. All right, a nucleus. A nucleus, or you could have many of them, we call that a nuclei. All right, this is another one of those terms that has many different meanings depending on the context. Nucleus, in terms of the central nervous system, is a group of nerve cell bodies deep within the central nervous system. All right, so what color is a nucleus going to look like? Compared to other parts of the brain, because nerve cell bodies are what, myelinated or not myelinated? Nerve cell bodies are non-myelinated. So what color are they? They look gray. They look dark, right? So nuclei are going to be dark areas deep inside somebody's brain, and they're functional areas because they contain a lot of nerve cell bodies and dendrites that are making connections with each other. All right, that's a nucleus. As opposed to a ganglion. A ganglion is pretty much the same thing as a nucleus, except it is where? In the peripheral nervous system. So a ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system. And we actually looked at one already. I did show you a slide of one already. Where was that at? Oops. Right here. All right, so here is a unipolar neuron entering the dorsal root. Here's a dorsal root. What is this? This is a dorsal root ganglion. And what's a ganglion? It's a group of nerve cell bodies. You see a cell body right there? No one sees a cell body right there? I see there's a big cell body of this what? Unipolar neuron. All right, and this is a ganglion because you're going to have thousands and thousands of these nerve cell bodies right in that location on the dorsal root. So we call this the dorsal root ganglion. All right, here you can see the motor fiber. What kind of neuron is that? Yeah, it's a multipolar neuron, right? So that interneuron is completely within the central nervous system. That's also an association neuron. Okay, white matter. All right, if gray matter is cell bodies and dendrites that doesn't have myelin on it, what can you tell me about white matter? It has myelinated sheaths around it. What part of a neuron has myelinated sheaths on it? Axons. Okay, so white matter are axons that are what? Going someplace really, really far away, and they are myelinated, so they look white. Sometimes, well, that's what we call white matter. All right, a nerve tract is white matter in the central nervous system. All right, so what does that mean? A tract is myelinated axons that are going someplace carrying information from one part of the brain to another, or maybe up and down the spinal cord. What can you tell me about information that is ascending, going up the spinal cord? Is that afferent or efferent? Afferent or efferent, going up. That is afferent because it is, yeah, it's sensory. It's information going through your brain for your perception. What about descending tracts carrying what kind of information? Efferent, carrying information from your brain that eventually will go to the periphery. So you have ascending tracts, descending tracts, and they're either afferent or efferent. All right, now what about a nerve? A nerve we don't have in the central nervous system. We have in the peripheral nervous system. Like when you bonk your elbow, you're crushing your ulnar nerve right there. All right, and so let's look at, so a nerve is white matter in the peripheral nervous system, but it actually has other things too. It has blood vessels, it has a vascular supply, it has connective tissue associated with it. As a matter of fact, a couple of different kinds of connective tissues. So, where was that nerve at? Right here. So here's a nerve in the peripheral nervous system. So there is a connective tissue sheath that surrounds the whole nerve that we call the epineurium. And then we see that inside the epineurium, there are different bundles. Guess what we call bundles? That's a fascicle. Does that ring a bell? Okay, I like for muscle, right? And there's a connective tissue sheath around every fascicle that we call the perineurium. And then the fascicle is made up of individual muscle fibers or axons, and there is even a connective tissue sheath around every axon, and that's called the endoneurium. Right, so you got epi, peri, and endoneurium surrounding the various divisions that make up a nerve. And of course, nerves have their own vascular supply. Arteries and veins supply nourishment to these neurons. And then deep to the endoneurium, you have the myelin sheath, and then inside the myelin sheath, you have the actual axon of that particular nerve that's going someplace. All right, now a nerve, unlike a root, can carry information to the central nervous system or away from the central nervous system. So depending on this particular axon right here, it might be an afferent or it might be an efferent axon. So nerves are what we call mixed, right? They carry mixed signals, afferent as well as efferent signals. But a root, what can you tell me about a root? Where was that root at? Here is a root. This one is 100% motor. And which one is this? This is the ventral root. Yeah, it's going to be afferent. And then here is the dorsal root. Don't forget, this is a sensory neuron, so this is going to be 100% afferent traffic. But where they combine right about here. And where they combine, that becomes a nerve. And the function of a nerve is what? Is what we call mixed. It has both afferent and efferent signals going through it. Okay. All right, so that was a neuron. Now we do just have to talk about a couple things, namely, the reflex. Okay, well, I think I'm going to start there next time, but what do I want you to look at as far as a reflex goes? All right. This right here is where we're going to start next time. All right, so I would like for you to look at this figure and break it down into 5 or 7 pieces. I want you to know the pieces that make up this figure right here, the building blocks of a reflex for next time. So how do you like nervous system so far? Is it fun?
Kind of complicated.
Kind of complicated? Okay, well, maybe next week it might be more fun. Read a lot over the weekend.